Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 21st, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleforum conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, and then, as always, questions from the audience, so please do be thinking of those questions. We'll hear first from Professor Mark D. Janis. He's the Robert A. Lucas Chair of Law and Director of the Center for Intellectual Property Research at the Maurer School of Law, Indiana University Election Law Center. We'll hear then, Professor Janis, from Ms. Rachel W. Apter. She's a Senior Associate at ORIC. With that, Professor Janis, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's great to be able to join you for this conversation. I look forward to it very much. The Apple versus Samsung litigation at the Supreme Court has taken an extraordinary turn in recent weeks, and it'll be fun to talk about that today. So both parties recently have conceded away hard-fought, long-held positions and have stampeded, I would say rather wildly, toward a supposed middle ground. That kind of development is not actually as laudatory and constructive as it might sound, and here's why. The middle ground isn't really in the middle at all. And I believe that that's the real story of this case as it goes forward. So I'm going to explain briefly why I say that and why I continue to see this case as presenting actually a simple statutory construction issue for the Supreme Court to resolve, and why that's so, even if many of us might also conclude that Congress ought to consider amending the statute that is in front of the Supreme Court for construction. So let me briefly recount these recent developments. Until recently, the central issue presented by the parties in this iteration of the Apple versus Samsung litigation was how to apply the phrase total profits in the special remedies provision for design patent infringement, which is section 289 of the patent statute. Apple had argued that total means total, even as applied to multi-component articles having valuable technical features in addition to design features. Samsung, on the other hand, had argued that total could mean partial, because not all of the profits on an infringing multi-component article were necessarily attributable to the design features, and this is an argument commonly referred to as an argument for apportionment of damages. So enter the U.S. government in the form of an amicus brief filed on behalf of neither party. The government, as amicus, argued that total did in fact mean total, thereby disagreeing with Samsung's apportionment argument. But the government also argued that in cases involving multi-component articles, profits might be calculated based on a component of the article, and thereby disagreeing at least to some extent with Apple's position. In offering this second argument, the government relied on the language article of manufacture in section 289, and it suggested a rather complicated multi-factor test for determining what the relevant article of manufacture would be. And among other things, that test would look to the design patent in determining the relevant article of manufacture. It would also look to the relative prominence of the design in the whole of the article. So this was, on the part of the government, a remarkable effort, I would say, to claim the middle ground, and both parties quickly gravitated toward it. At oral argument, Samsung announced that it was giving up its argument as to total profits, giving up its apportionment argument, at least in that regard, and embracing the article of manufacture analysis. Apple, on its part, conceded that total profits indeed might be calculated based on components of multi-component devices, although it said that Samsung had waived that issue. And virtually all of the court's questions at oral argument centered on this article of manufacture analysis. So why do I insist that this is not middle ground and this is not necessarily a constructive development? And these are some arguments that I raised previously before the court in an amicus brief that I and a colleague filed on behalf of a group of intellectual property law professors. And the answer is based on the relevant language of Section 289, this special remedies provision. It says, whoever, in relevant part, whoever during the term of a design patent without license applies the patented design to any article of manufacture for the purpose of sale shall be liable to the owner to the extent of his total profit, but not less than $250. It uses the phrase total profit, and it uses the phrase any article of manufacture. And my problem with the direction that the case has gone is that just like Samsung's apportionment argument that's now been conceded away, this article of manufacture analysis that's been proposed by the government contravenes the statutory text. It contravenes the logic of the statute. It's not compromise middle ground. It actually facilitates an analysis that I believe is the equivalent of the very apportionment methodology that Samsung purported to give up. So briefly anyway, why do I say this? Well, first, with regards to the statutory text, the statute is clearly referring to the alleged infringer's article of manufacture, not the patentee's article of manufacture. And the statute imposes liability for applying the patented design without license to any article of manufacture for purpose of sale. This language calls into question, at the very least, calls into question the proposition that the article identified in the design patent should be a principal factor for determining what constitutes the relevant article of manufacture for Section 289 purposes. It should be the infringer's article of manufacture. So just to provide an example, in my view, if I have a design patent on the Statue of Liberty, which actually was the subject of an old design patent, and someone else without authority were to make a Statue of Liberty clock or a Statue of Liberty set of diamond earrings, in my view, Section 289 as it presently exists should give me total profits on the clock or on the earrings, assuming that infringement's been found, and it should not be relevant to the damages inquiry that the article of manufacture that is identified in my patent is a design for a statue, or as it said in the actual patent, a design for a bust. The fact that the infringing articles are something different from that should not matter for purposes of the damages inquiry. So that's one problem. Another problem, and a problem that illuminates the reason that I say that this is not really middle ground, is that I think that the government's proposed factors test is a backdoor invitation for courts to engage in the very sort of apportionment that Samsung had been pushing for all along. That's why I say this is not middle ground. Another reason I say this is not middle ground. And so if you think about that in the context of the logic of the statute, what the government and now Samsung is saying is that under the guise of interpreting the statute, the government and Samsung are saying that that Congress, in writing this statute, slammed the door shut on an apportionment argument by including the phrase total profits, but then left the door wide open by including the phrase article of manufacture. To me, this does not sound like statutory interpretation. And I don't think it's an answer also to suggest that this sort of question about the article of manufacture will only be implicated in a very small number of hard cases. I think actually in application, everything is going to be argued to be a multi-component article that is subject to this test, and that it will be very routine for litigants to have to engage in very elaborate arguments at the damages phase about what the article of manufacture is. So I think that's problematic. And lastly, I would say, just by way of these opening remarks, that these arguments that I've been making are arguments about statutory construction and about judicial restraint. And, you know, my bottom line, as you can tell, is that this is actually a pretty simple matter of statutory construction, because the statute says very clearly total profits, and it says very clearly any article of manufacture. And I think the court could resolve the case by saying the statute means what it says. That is not the same as arguing that the statute as it is currently constituted is the best way to the best rule for design patent remedies. I think that there are important policy considerations that the court would leave unresolved if the court were to proceed in the manner that I suggest, but I think that those policy considerations are matters left that ought to be left for Congress, and I think that Congress is best suited to consider them comprehensively. And just by way of conclusion, I'll give you a few reasons for that. Congress is in the best position to take account of the varying needs of the many diverse industries that might be affected by a ruling on design patent remedies. Congress is in the best position to take into consideration the eclectic nature of the design patent system, which draws from copyright, it draws from trademark, it draws not just from utility patent rules, which are the origin of the apportionment analysis. And finally, Congress has the luxury of taking the 10,000-foot view. And when you take that point of view, you begin to realize, I think, that this statutory provision has two components. One component is the total profits part. The other component provides a minimum set statutory amount of damages. Congress, when it originally wrote the statute, I believe thought that that statutory minimum amount of damages actually was very important, because at that time there was no reasonable royalty rule in patent law guaranteeing a minimum amount of damages. So I think Congress really thought that many cases in design patent would actually turn on that part of the provision and not on the total profits prong. And indeed, early on they did, but as you might have heard when I read it, that the statutory minimum is $250. That sounded great in 1887 when the act was passed. It doesn't sound so great today. Congress is in the best position to revisit this statute comprehensively, to put into place a meaningful statutory minimum, and thereby take the pressure off very complicated total profits analysis. And that would be a good task for Congress to take up. It's not an appropriate task, in my view, for the court to take up under the guise of statutory interpretation. So those are a few opening remarks, and hope that that provokes some good discussion today.
Very good. Rachel Apter, you want to give us your first thoughts here?
Yes, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to participate on today's call. I want to take a step back and provide a little bit of background on design patents and how they work. So a design patent protects only a new and original design for a product. It does not protect how the product works or what the product does. It only protects what the product looks like. And this means that as a practical matter, there is basically no such thing as innocent design patent infringement. So a design patent is infringed if, in the eye of an ordinary observer, two designs are substantially the same, if the resemblance is such as to deceive such an observer, inducing him to purchase one, supposing it to be the other. But because human creativity is infinite, there's always the possibility of creating a different non-infringing design. So there are infinite possibilities for what a car or a smartphone or a pair of shoes could look like. But design patent infringement occurs when one company copies a competitor's design, generally in order to capitalize on that competitor's success in the market. So two examples. The iconic design of the glass Coke bottle, which was design patented in 1915, people believe is what led to Coke becoming one of the most widely distributed products on Earth. A 1949 study showed that more than 99% of Americans could identify a bottle of Coke just by its patented shape. And the bottle then became the signifier of the drink and of the entire Coca-Cola brand. But there are obviously many other possible ways to design a soda bottle. So if a competitor had copied the Coke bottle in 1949, it would have been for one reason: to profit off of the success of Coca-Cola in the marketplace and to capture part of Coke's market share. One other example that actually was discussed at length, both in an amicus brief that I helped submit to the court and also at oral argument, the Volkswagen Beetle. So the Volkswagen Beetle is subject to a design patent most recently from May 2015. If a competitor were to copy the patented design of the Volkswagen Beetle down to the very last detail, that would obviously not be an accident. There are obviously many other possible ways to design a car, as not all cars on the road look like the Beetle, but the competitor would be intentionally trying to profit off of the Beetle's success in the marketplace, either to convince someone to buy the copycat car, believing it to be a Beetle, or just to capture the goodwill that the Beetle design evokes in consumers. And this is why Congress passed the total profit rule in 1887. The House report at the time said the patentee is entitled to all the goodwill the design has in the market. And so, after the analogy of trademark law, is entitled to all the profit the infringer made on the goods marked. And as I just mentioned, those who copy patented designs understand this better than anyone. That's why they're copying the design in the first place, to co-opt the success of the original product. At the Supreme Court, Samsung argued that nonetheless, it cannot possibly be that total profits means total profits, because under this rule, an infringer of a patented cup holder design would have to pay its entire profits on a car. An infringer of a patented marine windshield would have to pay its entire profits on a boat. An infringer of a patented musical note icon on a computer would have to pay its entire profits on a computer, and so on. And some of these examples also were explicitly discussed at oral argument. The cup holder was mentioned and the marine windshield was mentioned. But Samsung's argument that someone who owns a patent in a cup holder would be able to collect total profits on an entire car ignores the test for design patent infringement that I mentioned earlier. Once again, it's if in the eye of an ordinary observer, two designs are substantially the same, if the resemblance is such as to deceive such an observer, inducing him to purchase one supposing it to be the other. So under this test, the owner of a patent for a cup holder would never be able to prove that a car infringed the patented cup holder design, because no one would ever purchase a car believing it to be a cup holder, or a cup holder believing it to a car, or would hold that the design of a cup holder was substantially the same as the design of an entire car, or vice versa. So instead, the owner of a design patent for a cup holder, of which it turns out they do exist. There are 26 total patents for cup holders of various kinds. So the owner of a design patent for a cup holder would have to allege that the car's cup holder infringed his design patent, not the entire car. And if he did prove infringement, if the infringing cup holder actually did look substantially similar to his patented cup holder, then he could be entitled to the profits on the infringing cup holder, but not the profits on the car in which the cup holder sat. And the same would be true for all the rest of Samsung's examples. No one could confuse a musical note icon for an entire computer or prove that a musical note icon looked like an entire computer. So you wouldn't be able to accuse an entire computer of infringing your design patent for a musical note. As to the article of manufacture argument that Professor Janis was so ably explaining, the statute specifies, as Professor Janis mentioned, that the article of manufacture is the thing to which the design is applied. So going back to the Volkswagen example, which played a big role at argument, if a competitor copies the look of the Beetle down to the last detail, then he should be required to turn over all the profits that he earned by doing that. But under this new article of manufacture argument from Samsung and from the government, the article of manufacture to which the design for the car was applied might not actually be the car. Instead, it might just be the body of the car. And so in that case, if that were true, then Volkswagen wouldn't be entitled to the profits that the copycat had earned on the copycat car. Instead, it would only be entitled to the profits that the copycat car had earned on the body of the car, as opposed to the profits that were earned on the engine, or the profits that were earned on the carburetor, or the profits that were earned on the gas tank, or, you know, every other piece of the car. So how one would actually determine what profits were earned on the body of the car versus the carburetor of the car is not clear. And as Professor Janis mentioned, it begins to look a lot like the apportionment that Samsung now agrees is prohibited under the statute. And Justice Kennedy specifically noted that at argument as well. So on that portion, I agree with Professor Janis and look forward to questions.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for those first thoughts. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts or both of them, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see who might ring in, let me make a quick announcement about what's ahead on the schedule. On Monday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about, in Teleform conference call, the PHH mortgage case that some of you might know better as the case that decided the constitutionality of the CFPB, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, a very recent ruling that the structure of the CFPB is unconstitutional, at least with a loan director. That's Monday at 2 p.m. We have three other Teleform conference calls scheduled next week, one on the census, one on the ongoing Chevron case, and another on the Harvard and North Carolina admissions policy cases where some potential Asian students challenge the admission policies of Harvard and University of North Carolina. Today, of course, we're talking about Apple versus Samsung. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take our first call of the day. Go ahead, caller, from area code 212.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Roberts calling. I'm an attorney in the legal department at Deutsche Bank.
You could speak up just a little bit, if possible.
Sure. I was just saying that my name is Michelle Roberts, and I'm an attorney in the intellectual property group at Deutsche Bank. Thank you so much to the speakers for your time today. I really appreciate it. I had a question to both speakers. The issue with respect to total profits, I think, is obvious in light of the cup holder example, but it seemed to me that counsel for Samsung in oral arguments was making the point that calculating damages based on the article of manufacture will still result in certain additional profits being swept up into that calculation, and gave the example of the fact that the screen design is also water-resistant, scratch-resistant, and shatterproof. And so I wanted to ask our speakers if they found that persuasive, and then also if they had any predictions for how the case would come out. I would love to hear those.
Who wants to take a shot at that first?
I'll be glad to. And first of all, do I find it persuasive? No. Because I think that that sounds exactly like the sort of subdivision that that is concededly forbidden under the heading of apportionment. And I thought it was very interesting that periodically through the argument, when these points were made, usually Justice Kennedy would pipe up and say, well, gosh, that just sounds exactly like apportionment to me. Is that, are you sure? And they would say things like, well, we're not going to use this word apportionment, but I think it really is apportionment by other language. What the argument seems to be is that there is a two-part analysis, and in the first part you would subdivide and identify this component or whatever other subdivision might be the article of manufacture. And then, supposedly, the patentee would have a chance to come back in the second part of the analysis and argue that the design meant so much to the entire purchase that the profits ought to be calculated on something beyond just the component. And at least that's the best I can understand as the proposed test. I just don't think that's going to work. I think that once the component is identified as the article of manufacture, I think that the analysis really, for practical purposes, is going to be done, and there really isn't going to be anything meaningful more that the design patent owner would ever get. The second part of your question was, how do I think it's going to come out? And I think it's really hard to tell. I think it's always a little bit tricky to predict these things just based on the oral argument. But if I were to do that anyway, I would say that the court would articulate some sort of generalized article of manufacture test and remand the case for determination of what the article of manufacture was in this case. And then the parties would be left to make very elaborate arguments about what that might be, and I think it would look a lot like relitigating the infringement question of the case, which I think would be unfortunate.
Rachel Apter, you want to take a...
Just that I agree that in all cases, it's very hard to predict where the justices are leaning after an argument, but I also agree that I think it was particularly difficult here because the arguments did not necessarily exactly track the briefing. Some of the justices seemed to be in one place at the beginning of the argument and then at another place at the end of the argument, and not sure which propositions were still being defended by whom. So I think it added an additional layer of complication beyond what exists in all cases, and makes it difficult to predict based on argument.
Once again, if you have a question, if you're in the audience, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. Our lines are wide open right now, no questions pending. While we wait to see if others might ring in, I think I heard from Rachel Apter that this is sort of a strict liability infringement on a design patent. And I'm wondering if in that circumstance, anybody, if Samsung, that is, made an argument, or anybody in their briefs made an argument to the effect of, if an entity now, things are so complicated, you're using thousands of patents maybe to produce a complex device, maybe more than one design patent even. If you infringe as a device maker on more than one design patent, you owe 100% of your profits to two different patent holders, and Congress could not have intended that as an outcome. Did anybody make that point, and if so, how's that received? Anybody want to take a shot at that?
Was that directed at you, Rachel? I wasn't sure. So there's a couple of answers, if I may just jump in and get started on it.
Sure.
The strict liability, as to the strict liability part, all infringement is strict liability under the patent statute, at least all direct infringement. Design patent, while technically direct, technically strict liability, the scope of many design patents is narrow enough that it would be surprising for there to be innocent infringement. That relates to the nature of the infringement test that Rachel mentioned previously. On top of that, there's a marking requirement, and it makes it all the more unlikely that there would be true innocent infringement, even though technically there could be. And as far as multiple recovery, Congress was certainly worried about that, and certainly there's language in the statute that says you can't recover twice for the same infringement. That's explicit in Section 289. It has not come up in the context of devices that are subject to multiple design patents, so that's a matter left to be determined. Certainly, mention was made of this stacking question in the briefs. I don't recall a lot of it being talked about at the oral argument, though. So that's a start on the answer to the question. Maybe Rachel has more than that.
Rachel, do you care to weigh in here? Well, this is Dean Reuter. I'm hearing a little static, so I'm not sure we still have Rachel Apter on the phone or not. To our callers, again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. I don't see a question pending. We might be having some technical difficulties. Could be Professor Janice. You and I are just speaking to each other. But you mentioned that in your opening remarks, this is a case of statutory interpretation. I've read the statute. I think your interpretation is the correct one. But is there a consensus on all sides and amongst the bench that that's what this case is about? It's just a pretty much a straight statutory construction case.
I don't think so. You're talking to someone who's thoroughly convinced that it is,
right.
And so maybe that colors my views. I see a lot of these arguments in favor of apportionment or arguments in favor of this sort of article of manufacture analysis as very much driven by policy concerns about overcompensation and very much driven by concerns that maybe Congress's choice to enact a total profits remedy was not the wisest choice. So from my perspective, this case, while it's been while there have been efforts made to tie those arguments to statutory interpretation, the thrust of it comes from what to me are policy arguments. And I certainly don't think I certainly don't think that those policy arguments go away no matter how the case is resolved. But I still think that it's the court's duty to interpret the language of the statute and leave some of these larger policy considerations to Congress. So certainly it is not the case that all sides would agree with that proposition.
Okay. I got an email from Rachel Apter that she's been dropped from the call, and she's trying to get back into the call. So I'm asking my colleague who's monitoring this phone call if she sees Rachel on the call dialing in from 973-452-8212 to unmute her telephone. I apologize for the technical difficulties, but if we could unmute telephone line 973-452-8212.
I think I'm on the call now. I'm so sorry about that.
We can hear you. I don't know how much of the conversation you were knocked out of, but I had asked earlier, just most recently, whether there's a consensus as to whether or not this is a statutory interpretation case. I don't know if you have a strong opinion on that. We've heard an answer from the professor.
I did hear that, and I think I agree that there's a lot that has come up that is not typical in a statutory interpretation case. One thing that I wanted to jump back to about the innocent infringer and what happens if there are many design patents on the same article. So the design patents that Apple had has on the iPhone might be a bit unusual in that there are a number of different ones that are that apply to different pieces of the phone. So there are design patents like the ones that are alleged in this case that apply to the overall look of the phone. So what it looks like on the home screen or what it looks like when someone's just holding it in their hands. But then there, I think there are other particular patents that apply to other things. Many design patents will apply to the look of an entire article of manufacture. So, for example, the Volkswagen Beetle patent is just what the Volkswagen Beetle looks like. And so, of course, in that case, there just wouldn't be the possibility of so many different design patents on the same product. One other thing is utility patents are oftentimes there's a, you know, a market for buying and selling utility patents in a way that there is not for design patents. Design patents are generally obtained for the design of the look of the whole product, which really is related to how the brand presents itself in the marketplace. And so it turns out that there are actually very few brands that are willing to license or sell their design patents. Licensing for design patents is very rare, as is patent trolls attempting to enforce design patents that they have obtained from the original patent holder. Because a design patent is generally obtained on something that is central to your brand, central to the way that your brand is perceived in the marketplace, and so you simply wouldn't want other people to be designing their products to look exactly the same as yours, because that would take away your market advantage. And that would take away the framework that consumers have to understand what are your products versus what are someone else's products. So that's a piece that is not the same at all as utility patents, and that really is relevant when it comes to the idea that there will be, you know, thousands of different design patents on the same article, or what it means in this case to be an innocent infringer when it really requires that you are designing something that looks substantially the same as something else. And generally in the case law, the only time that that happens is when you're trying to profit off of the other company's design.
Right. Let me make another call for questions here. I don't see any questions on the board. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I apologize if you're trying to do that and not showing up. It could be that we're having some technical difficulties here. I'm uncertain. So in the absence of an audience question, let me ask one more question I think, betray my ignorance on this front. But the design patent and the utility patent, are they 100% distinct, or is there any overlap? It strikes me that, for example, one of the design features of an iPhone is its curved corners that makes it sort of functionally easy to get in and out of your pocket. So there's some utility there, too. The Coke bottle you mentioned certainly has aesthetic qualities, but it also the Coca-Cola sort of pours out of the bottle in a way it wouldn't out of some other bottles. So that's the question. Is there overlap there in the cases where there is overlap between aesthetics and utility? Is it a design patent? Is it a utility patent? Or is it something different altogether?
Well, this is an ongoing difficult issue for any kind of design protection. It's a separate issue from what's before the court.
Right.
Currently, in fact, the court declined to grant cert on this sort of question. But to answer your question directly, design protection extends to the appearance of an article to the extent that it's not dictated by the function. And so in the example of a Coke bottle, because there are many alternative appearances that would still carry out the function, the functions that you mentioned, one could readily conclude that that particular appearance is perfectly fine to protect by a design patent because it would leave other competitors free to create bottles that look differently but still poured easily. that's a very complicated, you know, case by case analysis in any kind of design patent case. No, please go right ahead. That's where I would go with that answer.
I think it is also, though, helpful to note that if you were able to prove, for example, that the corners of the phone are dictated by function because that's the only way that the phone could slide in and out of your pocket, then that would be the same as showing that it was not patentable under a design patent. And, of course, you know, that's not an issue in this case. But that is just to say that if someone is trying to obtain a design patent for something that really is just functional and therefore that other people would run into copying by accident because they want to achieve the same function, then that is a reason to prove why it cannot be patented by a design patent at all. A design patent is only supposed to apply to something, as Professor Janice mentioned, that is not dictated by function. And so if the design is dictated by function, then it cannot be patented through a design patent.
Interesting. Let me make one final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And if we don't get a question, I'll come back to each of you for a final thought here. I don't see any additional questions, and again, I apologize if you're trying to get in with a question. We're not seeing them. We might be having some technical difficulties. But let me go in reverse order than we started and get a final thought from each of you. I assume since it's hard to make a prediction about how a case will come out, it's just as impossible to make a prediction about when a case will come out. But a lot of our Supreme Court cases wait until June. I don't know if you have an inkling whether this October case won't be decided until the end of the term or might be decided somewhere along the way. But if you want to touch on that and give us any final thoughts you have, I'd be happy to have them. Rachel Apter first, please.
Sure. I have no idea when the case will be decided. As you know, it's somewhat unusual for cases that are argued in the first sitting to wait all the way until the end of the term to be decided. But part of that depends on which justice is assigned the majority opinion, whether or not there's a dissent, which justice is assigned the dissent, all things that we on the outside have no way to know about. So, you know, I think that an opinion in this case could issue any time within the next 2 months or all the way until June. And I think a really interesting piece of this case is not only how it will be determined, but then seeing how whatever the law that the Supreme Court settles on actually will be applied. Because as Professor Janice discussed, this is kind of a new test that has not been previously discussed by courts. And, you know, there are certain parties that think that it will be a disaster for design patent infringement cases and that a company like Crocs, for example, that submitted an amicus brief in this case and that patents the look of all of their shoes will no longer be able to enforce those patents because all of a sudden everyone will be able to copy the patented look of Crocs and then argue that actually the patent doesn't apply to the whole shoe or part of it is related to the foam and things like that. But then other parties think that it's no big deal and business will be able to go on as usual. And, you know, amicus briefs in support of Samsung were arguing that design patents are already too important and should be reined in. So I think not only how the Supreme Court decides the case, but then what that ends up meaning in the real world will be something that is really interesting to look out for in the coming months and even years.
A final thought from Professor Janice.
So I agree with respect to the timing. I guess I would think that probably it will come down sooner than June, but all those other factors have to be taken into account, so hard to tell on that. I also agree that this is far from the final word. Whatever the court does is going to be, I suspect, very difficult to apply in the lower courts, including in this very case, much less other cases that we can't even imagine yet. And I continue to think, as I have for a while, that given the prominence of this case, it may very well lead to maneuvers to get Congress's attention. So perhaps there'll be at some point a legislative exercise here. And just one final thought, it does surprise me, at least on the basis of listening to the oral argument, that this case has not, at least as of yet, been used as a vehicle for warning parties about adhering to the text of the statute. A justice who really wanted to and really cared about the textualist argument could really use this case as a vehicle for it, because it really does look like a case of plain language arguments on the one side and policy arguments on the other. And naturally, all those points can be contested, but it does surprise me that the case hasn't turned in that direction yet, and really no, shows no signs of ever doing so. So for that reason as well, I think it's also a case to keep an eye on.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and it'll be my sense is, based on what I've heard today, it'll be a case that should lead to some interesting opinions from various justices. I want to thank you both. This has been a very interesting discussion for me, and I'm sure for our audience. Thanks both to Rachel Apter and Professor Janice. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference call Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.